WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, B.B. King, the great blues guitarist and singer, tells us how he developed his style and about the tractor accident that forced him off the plantation, inadvertently launching his music career. He grew up in Mississippi, a sharecropper's son. He tells his story in his new autobiography. B.B. King, coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. President Clinton is calling for the expansion of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. The president says NATO should admit more Eastern European countries into the military alliance. Mr. Clinton told an audience in Detroit that the alliance must work to overcome Russia's objections.
We are building a new NATO just as we are support the Russian people in building a new Russia. By reducing rivalry and fear, by strengthening peace and cooperation, NATO will promote greater stability in Europe, and Russia will be among the beneficiaries.
President Clinton says new countries should be admitted into NATO by 1999, the alliance's 50th birthday. Republican presidential candidate Bob Dole says the president shouldn't wait 4 years to admit new NATO members. Dole wants to admit Poland, Hungary, and the Czech Republic by 1998. Marines from Camp Pendleton have been called in to help battle wildfires in California. The worst of the blazes is in Carlsbad in northern San Diego County. That fire has destroyed 60 homes and burned more than 5,000 acres. Lieutenant Greg Freed says the high winds have made the fire tough to control.
The main problem has been the high Santa Ana winds. There were winds blowing, I understand, 45 miles an hour overnight, and created an extreme hazard and difficulty in dealing with this fire. And that's the main concern of the firefighters trying to control this blaze.
A wildfire in Malibu remains out of control after scorching more than 13,000 acres. Flooding in the Northeast is keeping people out of their homes, children away from school, and businesses shuttered today. Swollen rivers are threatening to surmount their banks and inundate already saturated ground. At least 6 deaths are blamed on the nor'easter. The United Nations Refugee Agency says it's evacuated more than 50 aid workers from eastern Zaire who had been trapped there for 3 days by fighting. The workers operated several refugee camps that are now empty. More than 200,000 refugees fled the continuing violence. NPR's Jennifer Ludden reports.
UN spokesmen say most of the refugees are hiding in the hills and banana plantations surrounding their camps, but many are making their way north toward Bukavu. There, the UN already cares for hundreds of thousands of refugees and has now set up an emergency camp to receive those fleeing from the south. Some 10,000 have arrived so far. Most of the refugees are ethnic Hutus from Burundi and Rwanda. They fear becoming a target in clashes between ethnic Tutsis and Zairean soldiers. And they're not the only ones afraid. Aid workers say local villagers are also joining the exodus. Meanwhile, there are continuing reports that gunmen are crossing over from Rwanda into Zaire, and that's fueling fears of a full-blown war between the two countries. I'm Jennifer Ludden reporting.
On Wall Street, the Dow's down 24 points. This is NPR. Israeli and Palestinian negotiators report some progress on civilian issues related to the withdrawal of Israeli troops from the West Bank town of Hebron, but negotiators are still stuck on security arrangements for Jewish settlers in the area. Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat says Israel is responsible for the deadlock. Israeli President Ezer Weizmann says Arafat is stalling because he thinks he has the world's support. Weizmann says if both sides work at it, an agreement could be finished by the end of the week. U.S. peace envoy Dennis Ross continues to mediate the talks. A study in the New England Journal of Medicine finds a majority of the people who lack health insurance have problems getting medical care or paying for it. NPR's Joanne Silberner reports.
During the debate over whether to reform the nation's healthcare system, some politicians and analysts said the number of people who lack insurance, about 40 million people, is a major catastrophe. Others said it was a non-problem, that people could always get care somewhere. So researchers from Harvard University and several other institutions asked nearly 4,000 people about their insurance status. People without insurance were 4 times more likely to say they had needed care and not gotten it than people with insurance. They were also much more likely to have a problem paying their medical bills. Extrapolating from the data, the researchers estimate lack of health insurance results in health or family problems for 17 million people. This is Joanne Silberner in Washington.
Negotiators for the Canadian auto workers and General Motors are still talking. A deadline set yesterday for the completion of an agreement passed, and no one has left the bargaining table. Both sides took a short break last night for some sleep, but returned to the table this morning. The union and the automakers say they're close to ending a 3-week strike that's idled 26,000 Canadian GM workers. The ensuing parts shortage has forced GM to send home another 18,000 workers in Mexico and the United States. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. B.B. King is the world's best-known living blues musician and arguably the best living blues guitarist. He's been recording since 1949 and has remained true to his style through countless shifts in the pop music world. His personal story is tied to an important chapter in Southern history as well as music history. He was a sharecropper's son who worked on a Mississippi plantation until he was a young man and made his way to Memphis. B.B. King tells his story in his new autobiography, Blues All Around Me. We're listening to his 1972 recording, Five Long Years.
If you ever have been mistreated, then you know just what I'm talking about. If you ever been mistreated, people, oh, you know just what I'm talking about. I tell you, I work for long years for a woman. And she had the nerve to put me out. You know I got a job at a steel mill, trucking steel like a slave. 5 long years every Friday, I went straight home. Well, all of my pain. You ever been mistreated, people? Then you know just what I'm talking about. I tell you, I work 5 long years for a woman, and she has.
B.B. King, what was your very first guitar like?
My very first guitar was a little red guitar about 2.5 feet long. It had a hole in the center, and it was made by a company called Stella. And it was red.
Did you think that was cool or silly?
No, I thought this was the greatest thing that ever happened to me. A guitar made a sound, you plucked the strings. Man, how much, how much more heaven can you have? That's the way it seemed to me at the time. Believe it or not, I still hear the sound of that sound, if you will, through the guitar that I play today.
You hear the sound of that very first red guitar?
Yes, I do.
Now, I love the way you describe developing your style. It sounds like you developed your style by trying and failing to imitate your influences. People like Lonnie Johnson, Blind Lemon Jefferson, your cousin Buckle White, Django Reinhardt, Charlie Christian.
Charlie Christian, yes. I'm still doing that.
But still trying and failing.
Yeah, trying and failing, yes.
You also loved Hawaiian guitar. How did you hear Hawaiian guitar, and how did it? Why was it so exciting to you? It was another sound you tried to emulate.
Well, I'd hear it on the radio. I would hear the Hawaiian sound, or the country music players play steel and slide guitars, if you will. And I hear that. To me, a steel guitar is one of the sweetest sounds this side of heaven. I still like it, and that was one of the things that I tried to do so much, was to imitate that sound. I could never get it. I still haven't been able to do it. And that was the beginning of the trill on my hand.
Tell me more about the trill on your hand.
Well, it's, how can I tell you? It's sort of like, it's not really pushing and pulling the strings like a lot of guitar players think I do. But it's like kind of just shaking your hand and getting a vibration on the string a little bit. So maybe a mini bit of pushing and pulling, but not from the strength of my hand. It's just from the shaking of it.
Now, also, you play a kind of single-line guitar as opposed to, chords or rhythm guitar. Tell me also about developing that style of single note.
Well, every time I've worked in a band, I was always featured. And they'd hardly let me play in the rhythm section. Usually, for some reason, most of the players would always say, B, take the solo, take the lead. And I got in the habit of doing that. So I put more emphasis on the single string than I did the chords. I can play a few chords, but I'm no great chord player. But, for example, if you were singing or playing, I could play chords pretty well behind you, with a guideline. The guideline mean if I had a bass player or keyboard player, somebody that's playing the chords, I could play then. I could play behind you very well. But other than that, I'm sad. Anybody hear me play by myself, I've just lost that person. They won't listen to me anymore. That's the end.
So did you feel that your strength lay not in just being a guitar player or in just being a singer, but in doing both together?
I think both together. I started to feel that I, had to be a good entertainer to keep a job. And I'm kind of happy that I developed in my head that I'm never any better than my last concert or my last time I played. So it's like an audition each time. Quite often, it's quite a bit like some say when you're going on stage, you have stage fright. In so many words, you get nervous just before going on stage. And I still have that, but I think it's more like concern. You're concerned about the people. It's like meeting your in-laws for the first time.
When I first got the blues, they brought me over on a ship. Men were standing over me, and a lot more was the whip. Everybody wanna know why I sing the blues. Well, I've been around a long time. I've really paid my dues. I've laid in the ghetto flats, cold and numb. I heard the rats tell the bedbugs to give the roaches some. Everybody wanna know why I'm singing. Yes, I've been around a long time. People, I've paid my dues. I
B.B. King is my guest, and he has a new autobiography called Blues All Around Me. You're from a family of sharecroppers. What was the work that you had to do?
Well, I was a regular hand when I was about seven. I chopped cotton. I picked cotton. I helped to plant it. I did everything that the grown-ups do, and that's mostly the work what had to do with cotton was the king, if you will, of produce in the Mississippi Delta when I was growing up. Peanuts maybe later, and soybeans later. But cotton still is today one of the main produces that's raised in the Mississippi Delta.
Now, what was the financial arrangement between your family and the plantation owner?
Well, a sharecropper was meant to be exactly what they say, sharecropper. But generally, the boss that owned the plantation did all of the paperwork, if you will. He was the CPA. he did all of that, and he sold the produce that you raised. For example, a family of maybe five or six would have maybe 100 acres to work, and maybe they would make 20, 25 bales of cotton, and it was all dealt with through the plantation owner. And at the end of the year, say late December, before Christmas, maybe 2 weeks or so, that's when we do what they call the settlement. And this is all done through the trust of the plantation owner. In other words, the sharecropper had nothing to do with it, but except what was told to him that had to do with his earnings. For example, Jim, you earned, after paying me back the advances I gave you, you made 25 bales of cotton, and the cotton brought maybe $5,000 a bale, and you owed me, say, 25 times that, except maybe $2,000. So here's your $1,800.
You know what I'm wondering? When you were growing up on a plantation, family of sharecroppers, did you vow to yourself early on, I'm getting out of here?
Well, not really. Believe it or not, people lived on the plantation, felt like that this was really home, most of them. And we are being taken care of because the boss of the plantation usually was like your lawyer, your judge, your father, your mom. He was your practically everything. And people lived on the plantation, sort of felt, believe it or not, secure to be there. If they needed a few bucks, usually they could get this from the boss man, and it's taken out at the end of the year. At that time, we didn't have telephones. We didn't have electricity or anything of that sort. Later on, I guess we had electricity maybe a year or so before I left when I was 18 years old. And this was all taken care of through a system that you would pay at the end of the year, which came out of your earnings. So a lot of the people, including myself, the early years, just thought that this was it. You know, this, you raise your families, and you get old, die, your families take over, kids and what have you, and it's an ongoing process, if you will. But I somehow later start to feel that there was more for me and a few others. I think it's the same way with young people today. They feel that they're not really happy with the status quo,
right,
if that makes sense.
Right. B.B. King, his new autobiography is called Blues All Around Me. He'll be back later in the program. This is Fresh Air. This is a national fundraising week for public radio. So before we hear more from B.B. King, we're turning to you. Your pledge is what enables public radio to bring you the kind of in-depth interviews and news coverage that you won't find anywhere else on the radio. The price of everything special that public radio brings you is the price of a pledge. It's worth it. Thank you. Thank you. This week we're featuring a series on the history of the blues from our rock historian Ed Ward. The recordings are selected from two blues box sets released by the Smithsonian Institution. Today on the second part of his series, Ed examines the rise and fall of the country blues and how the blues were transformed by the Depression.
I want all you people to listen to my song. I want all you people to listen to my song. And remember these words I say after I'm dead and gone. Worry.
By the time the Depression hit in 1929, Americans were well familiar with the term the blues. Even a few of them had ever heard the kind that came out of the Mississippi Delta. And over the next few years, they'd become more familiar with having the blues. The word blues, in fact, was showing up all over the pop music landscape, and the blues as a musical form was an important component of all the jazz compositions of the day. For the blues as music, one immediate effect the Depression had was to make time so hard that few of the people who had supported the blues record industry could afford to keep buying phonographs, records, or even phonograph needles. The big labels dropped marginal music right away, so much of the music from the 1930s that documents the blues was recorded by discount labels who made inferior pressings. Thus, some important music was recorded, but the records on which it survived are often in bad shape. The most notorious of these labels was Paramount, a division of a furniture company located in Grafton, Wisconsin. They'd record anything, and we're lucky they did. It was Paramount which zeroed in on Charlie Patton, who was the center of the Delta blues scene, a fairly unpleasant man who was a charismatic performer, a guitar wizard, and who attracted younger musicians to him like a magnet. Among the performers who got their chance because Patton's Pony Blues sold so well were his friends Son House and the great Skip James. James, with his eerie voice and totally idiosyncratic guitar style, easily coexists in my mind with Robert Johnson as the greatest of the Delta bluesmen, particularly since he lived to be rediscovered and, if anything, had improved in the intervening 30 years. But what of Robert Johnson? Those who discovered him through the Columbia reissue of his Complete Sessions will perhaps be surprised to learn that, although the American Recording Company showed enough faith in him to record 29 songs, only one sold well enough to recoup the investment.
I went to the crossroads, fell down on my knees. I went to the crossroads, fell down on my knees. Had a lot of bourbon, mercy.
Johnson may have been a great singer and guitar player, and he may have been a legend at home, but his records came out in 1936 and 37, and no one could afford them. Since he died in 1938, he never had a chance. In fact, Robert Johnson's death coincided with the death of country blues recording at large. Only the city blues performers might sell well enough to justify recording them, and a migration of blacks from the South to places like Chicago meant that the music was changing, too.
Thank you. good. Can I go home with you? Can I go home with you? Now you can tell your mother and your father that Sonny Boy's a little schoolboy.
Performers like the original Sonny Boy Williamson assuaged the homesickness so many of these transplanted Southerners felt and became major stars on Chicago's South Side, where the Bluebird label, a division of Victor, ruled the roost.
And it do, I want you for my own, and it do. And it do, I want you for my own, and it do. To be mine, no matter what you say or do.
Furthermore, city blues performers had discovered the electric guitar.
They call it Stormy Monday, but Tuesday's just as bad. They call it Stormy Monday, but Tuesday's just as bad. Wednesday's worse, and Thursday's also sad.
The seeds were being sown by the time of T-Bone Walker's mammoth Stormy Monday for a revolution in the blues. But first, the world would go to war.
More on that tomorrow when Ed Ward's series continues. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. And this is NPR, National Public Radio. Coming up, we continue our conversation with B.B. King. He began recording in 1949. This is his first record, Miss Martha King.
Yes, I'm sitting here thinking, thinking about Miss Martha King. Well, I'm sitting here thinking, thinking about Miss Martha King.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Random House, publisher of Will America Grow Up Before It Grows Old? How the Coming Social Security Crisis Threatens You, Your Family, and Your Country, by Pete Peterson, director of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with the second part of our interview with B.B. King, the great blues guitarist and singer. He has a new autobiography called Blues All Around Me, in which he describes his journey from Mississippi sharecropper to the world's best-known blues musician. You grew up on a plantation, then left it to go to Memphis which is where you started really playing music professionally. It's a great story how you left the plantation. You were driving a tractor. This was a problematic tractor that had it had problems with after ignition. So one day you turned off the tractor, walked out of the tractor, and then the tractor started jumping on its own, rammed into the barn. The exhaust pipe got crushed or, you know, broke off.
Broke off, yes.
And you were afraid of how much money you'd owe the plantation owner.
No, I was afraid that I would be killed.
Oh, even worse.
No. Well, he'd never kill anybody, but he, I don't mean it that way, but scared to death. You know, like if you, your mom cooked a cake and you decided that, you know, you're going to get a piece of it and you drop it, you know, and it spills on the floor. Brand new cake that's made for the family, you would feel that mom is going to surely kill you, so you better get out of there. Well, that's the way I felt that the time that the tractor, when it backfired, you know, and ran out of there, scared me half to death. So I panicked and left, hitchhiked to Memphis. Going from Indianola to Memphis then was like, to me, like leaving Chicago, going to Philly. It was that far. That's the way it seemed at the time. So I was scared to death. I left and stayed for a while and communicated back with my family and my cousin Booker White. Said, go on back there and take your medicine. So I finally went back, and Mr. Barrett was a very nice guy, a man that I admired so much. I wished I could be a lot more like him.
You know, the good thing is, too, is that that accident forced you to leave the plantation. Maybe you wouldn't have left if it wasn't
No. I had planned to leave.
You did?
Yes, I had planned to leave. I had worked with a group called St. John Gospel Singers, and I thought we were very good. And believe it or not, I thought we was getting close to being like the Soul Stirrers, you know. With
the Sam Cooke's group.
Sam
yeah.
Cooke, you got it. The Golden Gate Quartet, that was... The Pilgrim Travelers and many other quartets that we admired and wanted to be like them. And I thought we was, you know, kind of a good opening act for some of them. And I'd wanted to leave 2-3 years before that. However, I had asked the guys a couple of years before to leave, you know, let's go. I believe we're ready. And each time the crops would be bad or something like that, and somebody would have an excuse, say, well, we didn't do so well this year, let's try it again next year. And I was about fed up with hearing that. I was about ready to go anyway.
What was Memphis like when you got there? What impressed you the most?
It was like, let's say you lived in Cairo, Illinois, and you moved to Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. That's what Memphis was like. Wow. Great big city. I'd never been in a city that large before.
And did you feel like, hey, this city is mine, or did you feel like, I don't belong here?
No, I felt that it was a place of learning because I was lucky. My cousin Booker White lived there, and I had a chance to meet a lot of people when I came to Memphis. And I would go down on Beale Street and hear all these fine musicians playing, especially on the weekends. Memphis was sort of like, again, Chicago or any of the major metropolitan areas, people was coming through, going east or west. In other words, it was sort of like a meeting place, if you will, a port for people traveling from different places. So I had a chance to meet a lot of great giants in the business, jazz and otherwise. So I felt it was something, or a place rather, that I could learn.
Bluesman Sonny Boy Williamson had a radio show when you got to Memphis, King Biscuit Time. And you went up to him and asked to sing on the program. It seems to me like you must have had the courage to just come in like that.
Well, before I left Indianola, my hometown, Indianola, Mississippi, I used to hear Sonny Boy over in Helena, Arkansas.
Mm-hmm.
He would come on air each day at 12:15 and... for about 15 minutes for the King Biscuit Company. And I felt that I knew him. It's sort of like watching TV or listening to you. A person listen to you and feel that they can trust you and feel that they really know you. You become like a name in the family. So that's the way I felt when I met him. I didn't know him, but it seemed to me I had known him all this time. So when I got to Memphis, he was in West Memphis, which is across the Mississippi River in Arkansas. I went over and I felt, I guess I would have been hurt very badly had he not talked with me.
He let you sing on his show.
Yes, he did. I guess he said a guy got this much nerve, and I'm very homely looking.
What'd you sing?
I sang one of Ira Jo Hunter's songs. Ira Jo Hunter, if you're not familiar with him, was a great songwriter and great musician. He made a lot of tunes, one or two that you probably have heard. Anyway, I sang one of his tunes called Blues at Sunrise.
And you got a response?
Very much so. Sonny Boy seemed to like it. And Sonny Boy was a very big guy, you know, and his eyes was not very clear, looked a little red-like, and he was a very big fella, and at that time I weighed about 127, and he stood about, 6 feet or more, and looking down on me, you know, like, hey, you better sing right, and I said, yes, sir.
Well, you ended up getting your own radio show as well as your own gigs in Memphis. When you were on the radio, one of the things that we had to do was sing, well, write and then sing a jingle for Pepticon, which was what, a kind of cure-all remedy?
Yes. Pepticon was a tonic that was supposed to be good for whatever ails you. And we sold a lot of it. And I think a lot of it had to do, I didn't learn until much later that it was 12% alcohol, so a lot of the older people bought it, especially church people. They bought a lot of it.
You're the only way to drink and be legit.
Well, I won't say that, but I do know that they bought it, and older people mostly bought it, and someone sent me a bottle about 6 or 7 years ago. I have it at home now, and it was, I think, 12% alcohol.
Would you sing the jingle you wrote?
Well, do you really want me to do this?
Mm-hmm.
You really do. Okay. Pepticon show is good. Pepticon show is good. Pepticon show is good. You can get it anywhere in your neighborhood.
And did that sell a lot of Pepticon?
We sold a lot of it. I used to ride the trucks on the weekend with the salesman, and people would stand in line, sort of like going to a concert or a movie. We sold a lot of it.
Now, you had a stutter, but here you were on the radio, playing records, selling the tonic that you were selling. Did you stutter on the air?
Not so much. I had a lot of help there at the radio station. Rufus Thomas, my boss, Mr. Ferguson, Bert Ferguson.
Was this WDIA?
WDIA.
Right, this was like the first all-black music format in the country,
yes,
I think. Yeah.
Right, mm-hmm. First one. And I had people like Professor A.C. Williams, Professor Nat Williams that was there.
Mm-hmm.
That was Mr. Kearns, Darren Kearns. There was so many people that were there that helped me out so much.
Now I want to get to another record recorded in 1952. You were 26. This is a recording of 3 o'clock Blues. It had been a hit a
yes.
few years before for Lowell Fulsom.
Right.
This was your first number one record on the R&B charts.
Very first.
You're coming into your own here, don't you think, as a stylist?
I'm a very happy guy to know that somebody tells me that I have a hit record. I was very happy to hear that. I think that's music to each performer's ear, to hear that they have a top-selling record or CD.
Let's hear it.
It's 3 o'clock in the morning. Can't even close my eyes. Oh, 3 o'clock in the morning, baby. Can't even close my eyes.
That's B.B. King, recorded in 1952. How did that record, your first record, went to number one on the R&B charts, change your life?
Well, it changed my life in many ways. One thing, financially, because I had been making about $60 a week at this radio station. And I would go out and pick cotton. I would drive trucks and tractors. I did everything to try to make ends meet, if you will, because my music wasn't taking care of me. And when I made 3 o'clock blues, I started then to get guarantees, maybe like $400 or $500 a day when I played out. And that made a big difference, as far as financially speaking, because then I could hire more people to work with me. It made life easier. I could get a driver to keep from having to drive all the different places by myself. And my wife and I was able to live better, able to pay the band better. I was able to do many things that I hadn't been able to do prior to that. And, of course, my popularity was much more popular, if you will. And I just started to feel then that I was a real entertainer.
My guest is B.B. King. He has a new autobiography called Blues All Around Me. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with B.B. King. In the 1950s, you toured on a black music circuit, and you weren't crossing over, even into the early 60s, to white audiences the way other African-American performers who were playing more rock and roll had started to do. Chuck Berry, Little Richard. Did you want to cross over? Were you frustrated that you weren't crossing over?
Well, in the beginning, I was really confused about the way the politics ran in music. I always thought if you made a good record, it was a good record. If it was a hit record, it was a hit record. And people, not black, not white, red or yellow, but people would like it. Some people would like it. But I learned quickly after I got into the music business that there are so many categories, and you can get lost. You're like a little fish in a big pond, and more so if you're a blues singer, blues musician.
Mm-hmm.
So I was not really wanting to be a crossover, actually, but I wanted all people to hear it and like it. I was hoping, rather, they would like it. And people like Ray Charles, people like Chuck Berry, all these guys to me were very talented, and they was very energetic. Lloyd Price and so on. All of them was very energetic when it come to playing music. They didn't play the slow, droopy drawers music like I did. So I found that maybe that was my reason, because they had things that I didn't have, other way musically or entertaining.
Well, they were playing to teenage audiences, and as you've always pointed out, your audience
was always my age and older.
Yeah, so... Mm-hmm. Could you imagine yourself crossing over to teenagers, playing to teenagers?
No, I could not. And again, I'm trying to say that to hear the people that I mentioned playing,
mm-hmm.
I was never envious of them, because me, I'm the country boy that left the country, but they never got the country out of me. So I didn't have that stage presence that they have. So I was never envious of them being able to get over, but I would hope that people sometime would pay more attention to what I was doing.
In the mid-60s, I guess it was, a lot of the rock guitarists started emulating you. I mean, you became a god to some of them. Mike Bloomfield, Eric Clapton. And that helped introduce your music to college audiences. And then you started playing the college circuit in addition to the places you'd already been playing. What was it like for you to start playing the college circuit? Did you feel like did it feel very different to you? Did you feel like you needed to change anything about your performance style? Was there anything you were doing that didn't seem to translate?
Yes, I was frightened at first. Here I am, a high school dropout, and I'm going to be playing to college audiences. Yes, I felt that I should wear a hard hat and be Fred Astaire or Nat Cole.
Be real suave.
Yeah. But I remember after 3 o'clock blues, I had a manager, and he told me when I was going, it used to be a saying that for a black performer, it was four theaters you had to play and be accepted before you would be accepted as a true entertainer. One of those theaters was the Howard Theater in Washington, the Royal Theater in Baltimore, and the master itself was the Apollo Theater in New York, in Harlem. So my manager told me then, I lived in Memphis, he said, don't go to New York and these other places. Oh, and by the way, the fourth theater was the Regal Theater here in Chicago. However, my manager said, do not go to New York trying to be Nat Cole or anybody else that's trying to be slick, because there are people that sweep in the floors that are much better than you'll ever be. So the best thing for you to do is go there and be B.B. King.
What good advice.
Sing 3 o'clock blues. Mm-hmm. Sing the song that you sing the way you sing them. He said, now, all these other people can do all of those other things, but they can't be you as you can be you. And that I've tried to keep from then until now.
It's been said that you've always felt bad that you dropped out of school, never went to college. Were you self-conscious about that when you were actually playing colleges?
Yes, very much so. I thought that shortcoming as far as the education was concerned would make me not be, good enough to play for a lot of those people.
But it was probably just the opposite, that your audience really wanted to be you.
Well, I don't know about that, but they did show me that they appreciated me being there. They mm-hmm. still do that. They showed me that they was really with me and supported me in what I was doing. So they gave me confidence.
I have met over the years a lot of people who've worked with you or toured with you. And it's just not possible, I think, to get anybody to say a bad word about you. I mean, your reputation is of somebody who treats everybody around him really well, with a lot of respect, always fair. Financially and in all other ways as well. And I'm just wondering if that's something that you consciously set out to do. I'm not just trying to be nice here. I mean, I think it's just a kind of a fact that you're known for this. I wonder if you think of yourself just naturally Mr. Nice Guy, or if it's something that you've felt really obliged to do and have been very conscious about doing.
There are some things that I've read that I truly believe in. I believe that one should treat others as they want to be treated. And that's one of the things that I try to live by, if you will, is trying to be fair to people as I want them to be to me.
B.B. King, his new autobiography is called Blues All Around Me. This is Fresh Air. B.B. King has spent his life playing the blues. It was a pleasure to be able to record a long interview with him. On public radio, we can give interviews and news stories lots of time because we know you want more than superficial sound bites. We know you'd like to see public radio continue to be there for you. But during this National Fundraising Week, we need you to be there with a pledge. Thank you so much for your support. My guest is B.B. King. He has a new autobiography called Blues All Around Me. I got a question about your autobiography.
Uh-oh.
The autobiography, which is co-written with David Ritz,
right,
goes into some of your kind of sexual life. And
I love women. Still do.
That's fine.
At 71, I still love them.
Here's my question, though. Did you have any intention of getting that explicit about your life as it ended up getting? Did he have to really push you to do that, or were you comfortable with
that? No, he didn't have to push me. When we agreed to do the book, I had said to David and some of my close associates that I would be as candid as possible.
Mm-hmm.
So someday after I'm dead, people are going to say, yes, B.B. King has 15 kids by 15 different women. So I might as well to get the heat now. It's all right. At least it's now in the open. But I must say, and I'll say to you, if had a chance to explain, I think a lot of people would understand it much better than I can say to you at this moment. But this was not love children. This was not something that just happened overnight. By the way, I've lived now 71 years, so this took a time to happen. And if I had my life to live over again, I would, at this time, knowing what I know now, would have done a lot of the things differently. But the ways of prevention at that time was not as easy as it is today. A lot of the people during my time coming up have big families. And the only way to prevent having a lot of children a lot of times had to do with doing things that a lot of men, especially this man, don't enjoy doing to prevent it. So there I am.
Okay.
I hope I've made a little sense.
So you're comfortable with the sexual material in the book?
I love my children. I don't say this to brag that I have 15 kids by 15 different women, but since it has happened,
mm-hmm.
I'm crazy about them. They all are doing well. Only two or three has been in trouble, and we've been in touch constantly since their early life till present time. I have grandchildren and great-grandchildren. I'm proud of all of them. Some of them went to school like I wanted them to do. I wasn't a very good father because I was away most of the time, but I was in touch. And most of them, the moms are still living, and we are in touch. Anytime that it's something needed, they've always been able to get in touch with me, the moms, that is. And they've lived their lives, and I've lived mine. It wasn't that usually something happened, but it was never something so bad until it was what we call knockdown, drag out. We've mm-hmm. always stayed in touch. And all the moms are living except three.
One of your recordings that I particularly love happens to be a recording with the Duke Ellington Orchestra. Your recording of Don't Get Around Much Anymore.
Right.
I mean, gee, you don't even play guitar on this. It's so strange. It's such a unusual recording. My fantasy is that someday you'll record an album of jazz standards.
You must be reading my mind.
Really? Well, go ahead and do it.
Yes, I'm hoping to do that someday with standard tunes like Don't Get Around Much Anymore and tunes of that kind. You know what else? I would also want to do an instrumental album doing tunes like the Beatles did and other known tunes like that of today. I would like to do both.
I had a feel to sing with the Ellington Orchestra. And,
frightening.
And not have a guitar. I mean, I don't think
was afraid to try to sing, and trying to play guitar would have been just too much. But today I'm more familiar with a lot of the standard tunes, and I would like to try and play the melodies instead of singing them.
B.B. King, it's really been such a delight to talk with you. Thank you very, very much for your time.
Thank you. You're very kind to talk with. I enjoy your voice.
B.B. King's new autobiography is called Blues All Around Me. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Bob Purdick, Audrey Bentham, Joyce Lieberman, and Dan Lachlan. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Sherrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Miss the Saturday dance. I heard they crowded the floor. It's awfully different without you. Don't get around much anymore. I thought I'd visit the club. Got as far as the door. I just couldn't bear it without you. I don't get around much anymore. Darling, I guess my mind is more at ease, but nevertheless, why stir up memories? Been invited on dates, I might have gone, but what for? I just couldn't bear it without you. I don't get around much anymore.
Fresh Air is available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $15.45 and includes shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.